WJCT in Jacksonville. This is our weekly news magazine and the news podcast of the First Coast. I'm your host, Vince Kong, and this is Redux. It's May 5th, and Florida is in the grip of an epidemic. Deaths from opioid overdose and murders associated with the drugs have increased exponentially in recent years. Governor Rick Scott has declared the state's opioid problem a public health emergency. On this episode of Redux, we'll look at what state officials are doing to lower the body count, as well as what's being done to treat addicts and prevent addiction locally. Then we have an update on the Hemming Park Five, as well as a couple of stories honoring military and police officers killed in the line of duty. But first, some news. As we enter the second week of the fraud trial of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown, things are going, well, pretty much as expected. Brown is charged with 22 counts of fraud and conspiracy and faces 350 years in prison and a fine of close to $5 million. The prosecution claims her former chief of staff, Ronnie Simmons, routinely withdrew money from a sham charity called One Door for Education and deposited the funds into Brown's personal bank account with her knowledge. Her defense? Simmons is in fact the mastermind of the sham charity, and he took most of the money for himself while depositing the remainder of the money in her account, telling her it was legitimate reimbursement for travel expenses. Now, to get you up to speed, we have WJCT reporter Ryan Bank.
Hey, how's it going, Vince?
Okay, so far, it appears everything is playing out as expected, or is it?
Well, the only real big surprise here is the length of the trial. We were looking forward to probably having a 15 to 17 day trial, which is extensive. Both the defense and the prosecution had a very long list of potential witnesses, but it looks like the defense may only call three witnesses, two character witnesses and Corrine Brown herself.
All right, so elaborate on that point. Brown took the stand this week, as many following the case expected. So, how did she do?
Well, I got to tell you, the testimony from the defense was at times funny. She made a lot of jokes in the Corrine Brown fashion. Anyone who has covered her for any length of time knows that she says what's on her mind. But then at other times, it was actually almost tragic, especially when she was describing how much she cared for Ronnie Simmons. This is a man that she says she thought of as her son. And they've known each other since he was in college and dating her daughter, Chantrell Brown. And she described feelings of betrayal, and she ultimately admitted that had she known, because she says that she did not know that Ronnie Simmons was taking this money from One Door, but that had she known, she would have fired him.
All right, so now we're on the subject of Simmons. He took the stand this week. His testimony could potentially be the most damning for Brown's case, no?
He's a linchpin for the prosecution. He is what's holding their entire case together. Because it's one thing to show that deposits were made from this One Door charity account to Corrine Brown's personal bank account, but it's an entirely different thing to say that she had complete knowledge of this. Many of these deposits were made in Laurel, Maryland, where Ronnie Simmons, her former chief of staff, lives. So what the prosecution needed to do was they needed to prove that Ronnie Simmons was taking orders. When asked why he wouldn't have just said no to participating in this sham, he said, and I quote, "You don't just tell her no."
All right, that's WJCT's Ryan Bank on the trial of former 12-time Congresswoman Corrine Brown, a trial that could wrap up as early as next week. You can follow Ryan's coverage of the case at WJCTnews.org. Thanks, Ryan.
Anytime.
Governor Rick Scott has issued an executive order that says an opioid epidemic has created a state of emergency in Florida. Scott's action will allow the state to immediately draw down more than $27 million in federal grant funding, which was awarded to Florida last month to provide prevention, treatment, and recovery support services. The Senate also passed a bill this week that would impose tough criminal penalties on people who traffic in fentanyl, which is a major contributor to a spike in overdose deaths. Senator Greg Stebe is the bill sponsor.
This bill creates criminal penalties for trafficking in fentanyl and synthetic drugs, allows a person to be charged with murder for causing a death through the distribution of fentanyl, and adds numerous fentanyl derivatives to Florida's controlled substances schedules to ensure all chemical variants of fentanyl are included.
On the local front, addiction and recovery specialists say help can't come soon enough. Last year, there were 544 opioid-related deaths on the First Coast. Valerie Rao is the medical examiner for Florida's 4th District and was a guest on First Coast Connect earlier this year to discuss the scope of the epidemic, including bodies piling up at the morgue so quickly her office can barely process them.
We have never seen this impact on our office. We have no space. We have to tell the hospitals and the funeral homes to keep the bodies because we have no trays.
Meanwhile, state officials were in Jacksonville this week to listen to the concerns of First Coast residents, including 27-year-old Tiffany Kearns. She's a former heroin user who has dealt with homelessness, health issues, and having a child taken away from her as a result of her addiction. But then, she found Gateway Community Services. That's a treatment center near Jacksonville's Riverside neighborhood.
I now have a full-time job. I now currently, because of Gateway and the way that they've affected my life and have helped me to see where I'm at. My family does talk to me again, and they're in Ohio, and I do get to speak to my daughters.
Gateway's medical director, Raymond Palm, was on First Coast Connect earlier this week to discuss the challenge of getting addicts help before it's too late.
So right now, what happens when an individual goes into the emergency department for any reason, but we're talking specifically about overdose right now, they're stabilized once they're revived, and then they're discharged. There might be given information about resources in the area, but they're left on their own. Fentanyl is such a powerful, powerful drug. Once the individual's feet hit the street, they go back to fentanyl. So it's a revolving door until they die, and that's when they show up at the morgue.
And then there's the issue of how some doctors are actually contributing to the epidemic by overprescribing opioids.
Look, we have to do more about educating doctors. We have some uneducated doctors, we have some ignorant doctors, and yes, law enforcement has to get involved with the bad doctors because we have those too. We've got to attack the problem there. That problem's been there for quite a while, and that's a problem that is ongoing. The newest problem that sort of emerged from this is the one that's killing people, and that's the fentanyl problem. That's not a doctor problem. Mm-hmm. So there are two fronts we have to battle on at this time.
Palm is now working on securing funding for a pilot program that provides addiction treatment before an overdose victim is released from the emergency room. Listen to the full interviews with Drs. Raymond Palm and Valerie Rao on our Redux page at wjctnews.org. Also sprinkled throughout this podcast will be comments from you, our listeners, about this state of emergency.
Pharmacist here in Jacksonville, and it comes from the doctors prescribing way more medication than the patient perhaps needs. I had a personal experience. My husband had a hip replacement. They prescribed 200 oxycodone and 60 OxyContin. My husband was only in pain for 2 weeks.
That was one of our callers, Becky from the Beaches, sharing her thoughts on the opioid epidemic on the First Coast. Now to switch gears, here's an update to one of our previous stories. Progressive activists say they're keeping the pressure on State Attorney Melissa Nelson to drop charges against downtown protesters after an incident in Heming Park earlier this month. As WJCT's Ryan Bank reports, members of the Progressive Coalition are framing Nelson's handling of the Heming Park Five as the first real test of her career as the area's top prosecutor.
Outside the state attorney's office, activists are standing in front of a large book made of poster board. Fernando Figueroa is talking as another person turns the pages to reveal pictures of their comrades being arrested on April 8th, just a couple blocks from here in Heming Park.
We're here today to call on Melissa Nelson to turn the page on the disgraceful past of Angela Corey and open a new chapter in Jacksonville. with civil rights and equal protection under the law for all.
The five were arrested at a demonstration against U.S. airstrikes in Syria after their verbal confrontation with a pro-Trump counter-protester turned violent. The Progressive Coalition believes the counter-protester was treated with kid gloves, while officers used disproportionate force against them, including one organizer who is hearing impaired. Organizer Michael Sampson says another group he works with, Color for Change, has collected more than 100,000 petitions demanding dropped charges.
So far, national organizations have been out here showing support. If the charges aren't dropped, then we'll see more.
In an emailed statement, State Attorney Nelson says her office is still reviewing the cases and is in contact with protesters' lawyers. The five are scheduled to be arraigned on May 10th. Ryan Bank, WJCT News.
As an emergency physician, there was a study that came out in late 2015 about chronic pain management. It was a study of over 33,000 patients, and one in 550 people who are on pain management by a pain management professional die of overdose of opiates. And this is a little bit of a collision course between the business of medicine and patient satisfaction scores. An administration pushing physicians to do their best to please people, and physicians being overrun by volume. And the easiest thing to do is, well, instead of counseling people that pain is a real phenomenon in life, that no matter what we do, the advances of modern medicine, I can't take all the pain away, and living with pain is part of the unfortunate reality of the human existence. And these collision courses of American culture and business culture and potent medicines that are so addictive, this is the result of it.
That was one of our callers, Calvin from Arlington. Now, switching gears, Northeast Florida kids who lost a parent in the military got to learn what it's like to work at the Jacksonville Humane Society. As WJCT's Lindsay Kilbride reports, the national nonprofit Tuesday's Children sponsored the trip last week. The group supports families of military service members and first responders lost in the line of duty.
11-year-old Christian is waiting for his turn to train Clifford to roll over. He's a brown and white mixed breed dog.
Why'd you come out here today?
I heard the word dog in the sentence and I wanted to come.
Animal behavior assistant Misty Gravigal is teaching him how to guide Clifford with treats. Christian is here with 15-year-old Jeffrey and 17-year-old Jordan. All of them have a parent who died overseas in the military.
Don't give up. Go get it.
Jeffrey is getting the hang of dog training.
Clifford, to me, was a very fast learner, kind of like I am. So, you know, we already got that bond relationship.
Jeffrey says he wants to be an FBI agent one day.
The criminal justice just really stuck out to me because my dad was in the military. You know, once he passed away, it just really got to know, like, well, I want to go into action, but I don't want to go into the military.
A Tuesday's Children spokeswoman says she's planning to reach out to the FBI to see if they'll let some kids shadow for next year's Take Our Children to Work Day. Lindsay Kilbride, WJCT News.
No, Cinco de Mayo isn't Mexican Independence Day, just for the record. But it is the anniversary of an important battle the Mexican Army won against French forces. Okay, history lesson done. In America, of course, we use this time to celebrate Mexican and greater Latino culture and heritage. Join Ryan Beck for a very festive edition of Indie Endeavor's City Sounds, curated by and recorded live at 1904 Music Hall in downtown Jacksonville, this Tuesday at 11 p.m.
And finally, police officers who died in the line of duty were remembered this week by the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. The tribute to fallen officers outside Veterans Memorial Arena included a roll call of those missing from the ranks, as well as a 21-gun salute and a missing man formation flyover by JSO's aviation unit. WJCT's Sid Hoskinson was on hand to collect sights and sounds from the event. Pictures are on our Redux page at WJCTnews.org, and here are some of the sounds.
I have a proclamation. Now, therefore, I, Lenny Curry, by virtue of the authority vested in me as mayor of Jacksonville, Florida, do hereby proclaim May 15th to May 21st, 2017, as National Police Appreciation Week, and hereby designate May 3rd, 2017, as Jacksonville Police Memorial Day.
Remember that what we do every day is to represent the will of law-abiding citizens and our forefathers who created this nation and its laws, and those who count on us to uphold them.
We still stand together.
We don't mind standing out in the heat for an hour versus what they sacrifice for lives of the citizens of Jacksonville.
And that's our show. You can find all of our audio and web stories at wjctnews.org. You can also stream this podcast as well as all of our on-air content on the WJCT app, which is available on iTunes and the Google Play Store. And of course, find us on your favorite podcast app and hit subscribe. I'm Vince Kong, and thank you for listening.